session number 12371, Reel 10.
Before he left, he gave me his wrist compass, which I still have. These were the last operations that number 137 Squadron carried out with the Whirlwind. From now on, we were going to concentrate on operations entirely using the Hurricane 4.
Why do you think?
I don't know. I happened to be there at the time. He probably felt that I was a friendly face. I was the squadron commander of the squadron that had captured him. You never can tell with these things why people do this sort of thing, but he took it off his wrist and he gave it to me. I'm now going to talk about Operation Twitch, which was the first attack against a ground target carried out by the Hurricane 4 in September 1943. As I'd said before, when we first got the Hurricane 4 with the rockets, we were not allowed to carry them over land because the Air Ministry didn't want them to fall into the hands of the Germans should an aircraft be shot down. But they now decided that a time had come to use these rockets against a land target. And the target that was selected was the Hahnsverdt Canal, which runs through the neck of Walcheren Island, where it joins up with the mainland. It is very nearly opposite the city and port of Antwerp. This canal was important to the Germans because it allowed them to pass material, food, ammunition down into the Belgian and French canal systems. It became even more important to them because number 609 Squadron, with their Typhoons at Manston, using only 20mm gunfire, were attacking ships trying to get into the Scheldt from Germany as they proceeded round the corner of Walcheren Island, just off Flushing, which is now called Vlissingen. These attacks were having a devastating effect on this German trade, and as I say, it resulted in greater importance being put on the materials that were being passed through the Hahnsverdt Canal. We were to attack the lock gates at either end with the object of putting them out of action for quite a period of time, because clearly if they were very badly damaged, it would take the Germans a long time to repair them. I was given the task of planning the operation. Clearly, the limitations that the Hurricane 4 had, firstly, that the operation would have to be carried out at low level. Secondly, that we were virtually defenceless, meant that the planning had to be very carefully done, and it was fairly obvious the operation could be carried out only under conditions of low cloud, so that if we were attacked, at least we would have the opportunity of getting into cloud. In other words, we were going to carry out this operation under rhubarb conditions. Again, because of the vulnerability of the aircraft, it was patently obvious that we couldn't come back on the route that we went out on. And so we were going to have to come back by another route. And this entailed us going right round the northern part of Valkran Island, which added considerably to the distance that we were going to have to fly. The total worked out at just about 300 miles. In order to do this, I had estimated that we would have to cruise to and from the target at no more than 120 miles an hour, which was pitifully slow. This allowed us 5 minutes at full throttle in the target area to carry out the attack, which required us to increase our speed to 220 miles an hour and to allow us to escape from the target area. But having got clear of the target area, we were going to be obliged to get back to 120 miles an hour if we were going to get home. The two Manston-based squadrons, number 137 squadron and number 164 squadron, were going to attack the southern gates, and number 184 squadron, which was based at Detling, was going to attack the northern gates. As the senior squadron commander of the two squadrons at Manston, I was going to lead the Manston operation. Each aircraft would be loaded with 8 rockets, each rocket fitted with a 60-pound high explosive head. Towards the end of August, we got the conditions we were looking for, with comparatively low cloud, which we have been told should extend over the whole of our route. We took off from Manston and headed for the Belgian coast. Now, the only small luxury we'd been able to allow ourselves in the routing of this operation was to fly a slight dogleg towards the Belgian coast. Otherwise, it would have meant that if we'd have flown directly from Manston, we'd have been flying very close to the Belgian coast for some time, in which case we'd have got into the German radar before we wished to do so. So we're going to fly a slight dogleg, which took us up the Belgian coast, well outside the German radar range, and then we turned in towards the Belgian coast, where we were going to cross in at Konoka, just north of Ostend. From there, we would pass over Breskens, where the ferry goes from the Belgian mainland to Walcheren Island, and then along the southern part of Walcheren Island, so that we could approach the target at right angles. The two squadrons were so deployed that my squadron, which was on the left, was going to attack the two minor gates, which came first, and number 164 squadron was going to attack the big gate, which was on the right-hand side. Having reached the knuckle of the Dogleg and turned toward Konoka, I was about 15 miles from the coast when the cloud disappeared altogether and we had 100% blue sky above us. Clearly, it was suicidal to continue the operation. And so we turned back. Two days later, we set off again, and on this occasion, we had just crossed out from Ramsgate when my control column got jammed, and we had to call the operation off again, and I was very lucky to get back to Manston. I began to realise that to expect to have rhubarb conditions all the way around this very long route was unrealistic. And there was a danger that we were going to either carry out the operation and have to continually come back because of the breakup of cloud over the continent, or else we were going to have to go on with the possibility of losing all the aircraft and perhaps not achieving any results at all. And so I told Group that I thought the only way the operation could be carried out successfully was for us to have fighter cover over the target, to which they agreed. And so number 198 squadron, a Typhoon squadron at Manston, which had succeeded number 609 squadron when they moved out of Manston, were nominated to give us target cover. It is interesting that during the period when we tried to carry out the two sorties from which we had to return, my senior flight commander, Mike Brown, after the second attempt, was suddenly promoted to acting squadron leader, posted across the airfield to command number 198 squadron. So he was now going to provide us with fighter cover over the target area, but equally important, he was a chap who knew exactly what we were trying to do. He'd carried out operations with the Hurricane 4 himself, and so he was in an ideal position to assess what he could see going on below him. Another interesting thing that happened during this period was that the CO of number 164 squadron changed, and a new CO was posted in, who was senior to me. And so he was now going to lead the operation. I don't believe it had any effect on what actually happened. He was an officer who had come from Flying Training Command and had very limited operational experience. 3 days before we set off on the operation, which finally did take us to the target, a team of actors and actresses came down to Manston and gave us a show of the play Flare Path, which was quite well known in those days. The leading lady, who will remain nameless, was a very attractive girl, and after the show we invited all the performers to come down to the officers' mess at Westgate to have some drinks and a little bit of food. While they were there, I tried to get off with the leading lady. So too did the CEO of No. 164 Squadron. And during the evening's tussle, I won the battle and managed to make a date with this lady in London, which was to be a few days after the operation on which we were about to embark. Needless to say, the CEO of No. 164 Squadron was very jealous of what I had achieved. On the day that we were to set off on Operation Twitch, I received a letter from this lady saying how pleased she was to have met me and how much she was looking forward to our date in London. I waved this in the front of the nose of the CO 164 Squadron, and he was very jealous and made all sorts of remarks about how lucky I was, etc., etc. And so I said to him, look, I'm going to put this envelope on my dressing table, this letter on my dressing table, and I said, if I don't get back from this operation and you do, you can keep the date. So we agreed to this, and he was much happier then. We took off from Manston and headed for the Belgian coast. The cloud was broken, and clearly, had we not been getting fighter cover, we'd have probably had to turn back again. But also, the visibility was not very good. There was quite a lot of mist. Now, we have been used, in all the operations we've been carrying out in the whirlwind, and even to a certain extent in the Hurricane 4 with the cannon, we've been used to crossing the enemy coast at very high speed. We were now going to be forced to cross it at 120 miles an hour, which was very painful, because the coast seemed to take ages to come up to us. And as we passed over it, where all the guns were, it really was as if we were in a balloon standing still. Directly we hit the coast, the guns opened up. We were flying at about less than 50 feet. And I'm not exaggerating in saying one could actually hear the fast-firing multiple machine guns that were being used. Within a minute or so, one of the 164 Squadron aircraft started to stream glycol and obviously been hit. We had, of course, up to this stage been maintaining radio silence. However, this pilot called up his own CO and asked what he should do, and he got no reply. So I said to him, turn back, fly out to sea as far as you can, and either bail out or ditch. The idea being that the aircraft would then not fall into the hands of the Germans. This is what he did, and he was in fact taken prisoner of war. We continued on our way, and as we crossed the Scheldt, we were below the level of all the ships that were parked there, and many of them took the opportunity, those that had guns, that had taken a pot shot at us. Anyway, we managed to get to the other side quite safely, and then started to fly down the southern coast of Vulcan Island towards our target. At one stage, we passed over a windmill, and standing outside was a man and a woman in traditional Dutch dress, and they waved to us. As I said, the visibility really wasn't good, and as a result, the CO of number 164 squadron, who was leading the wing, passed the target. We had taken all the steps we could to get pictures of the target and try to estimate the width, because this was going to be very important so far as our own attack was concerned. We had built a rudimentary model back at Manston so that we could work out our tactics. But as it turned out, when we eventually did attack the target, it was much smaller in width than we had anticipated. When the CO of number 164 squadron realized that he had passed the target, we then turned 180 degrees, all at low level, which meant, of course, we were now all the wrong way round. So when we arrived at the target, instead of being able to turn in a fairly orderly fashion, the whole thing became a bit of a mishmash. I went in first to the gate that I was meant to be attacking, and the CO of 164 squadron was almost alongside me, heading for his main gate. Just as he was about to open fire, he was hit by anti-aircraft fire and flew straight into a house that was on the side of the lock gate and blew up in a cloud of flames and dust. I fired my rockets, was unable to see the result because I was over the lock gates and dodging down to 0 feet again, heading for the northern part of Vulcan Island. No sooner was I clear of the target than I throttled back to 120 miles an hour. I was all by myself, utterly vulnerable. I flew as low as I could, realizing it was my only hope. And it seemed to take hours to get round the north of this island. There I was, over the water, with the great cliffs that tower up on that side of Vulcan Island, away to my left. And I was keeping my eyes open for German fighters. None seemed to appear, but it seemed to be me so improbable that we could carry out such an attack and not attract German fighters, even though we did have fighter cover above us. Eventually, after what seemed ages, I got far enough out into the North Sea to be able to turn towards Manston and feel comparatively safe. I was then able to take stock of the damage that my aircraft had received. I knew that I'd received some damage because there was a considerable amount of vibration, which indicated that probably a piece had been taken off my propeller. I noticed various holes in the aircraft, And I then also noticed that there was a big patch of blood on my right arm inside the elbow. I'd not felt anything, and I still didn't feel anything, but clearly I'd been hit by something. But perhaps the most significant thing that I noticed was out on the end of my starboard wing was a duck swinging backwards and forwards, trapped by its neck, which I'd obviously picked up somewhere over the Dutch islands. I flew back to Manston and I landed, and in fact my ground crew had the duck for supper. We lost the CO of number 164 squadron, the pilot who had landed in the sea, who was of course taken prisoner of war, and I lost one of my flight commanders, a Canadian, very experienced pilot, who I had made up to acting flight lieutenant when Mike Bryan had gone across to command number 198 squadron, and he was wearing his flight lieutenant stripes for the very first time that day. His name was Dehou, a French Canadian. A great loss to the squadron. Well, our next interest was, of course, to find out what damage we'd done. When Mike Bryan arrived back with his 198 Typhoon squadron, he maintained that the attack had been very successful. He'd seen the rockets hitting the gates, he'd seen the flames, he'd seen the dust and the debris as a result of the attacks. The fighter reconnaissance aircraft were sent out to photograph the target. The photographs were brought back, sent up to the Air Ministry, where they were sent to the photographic interpreters. The result of the interpretation was little damage done. Well, of course, nobody could believe this. It was absolutely ridiculous. Pilots, for instance, who'd come behind me had seen my rockets hit the gates, and others had seen other rockets hit the gates. And knowing the weapon we were using, we couldn't believe that it could have, that the gates could have suffered so many hits and no damage had been done. Clearly, the Air Ministry, with the evidence they were getting, particularly from Mike Bryan, who knew what he was talking about because he himself had used this weapon and he had been sitting above observing what was going on, the Air Ministry were clearly unhappy with the result of the interpretation and felt there must be something wrong somewhere. And we discovered very quickly what this was. The arming device in the head, the 60-pound head of this weapon, was designed to operate so that as the cord